I'm James Gwertzman.
I'm Kristen Cox. Welcome to the Art of Live Ops podcast.
Hey, Kristen.
Hey, James. Thanks for joining me again.
Yes, this is an unusual podcast because we're both home.
Yeah, this is our first podcast recorded during the great lockdown. So I think it's going to go well, though. Today, we are going to be interviewing Tim Nixon.
I helped build a new games company as part of a documentary filmmaking unit called Natural History New Zealand. We made games for National Geographic and partnered with the World Wildlife Fund. We made our first game called Flutter, which was a game about exploring the rainforest as a butterfly. We were making that transition to mobile at the same time that mobile was just getting totally taken over by free-to-play. So the entire ecosystem of mobile changed from your premium titles to free-to-play. We put those things together and partnered with a publisher called DNA and worked to create the mobile version of Flutter. That combination was the right combination, which led to our first big success. And from that point on, the company, which we called Runaway, was a great success. And that was the start of a series of games, which all have this central core philosophy of, you know, teaching people a bit about the natural world, some light socialization elements in there as well.
And he's working right now with that game company.
Yes, he works at that game company now. And he's actually been doing Live Ops for a while. He's only been at that game company for a couple of years, but he has a long history of Live Ops sort of being at a studio in New Zealand that was sort of on in the early wave of social and mobile gaming, and did a lot of really interesting games out of that space.
Well, I'm so excited, the idea that he's brought that experience from social mobile gaming to working with, you know, Genova Chen, and who's probably one of the premier kind of game designers out there at the cutting edge of sort of narrative. And so hearing his experiences bringing sort of game, you know, live ops experiences, game as service models to a narrative structure will be really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think he's going to have a lot of really unique perspective and really cool experience. So let's dive into it and get to the interview.
All right.
So that was the sort of an overview of my time with Runaway, the 8 years there. And then I decided to move on from Runaway to sort of see a little bit more of the world and move on from New Zealand. And I had known Genova and Kelly from that game company for a while and was sort of starting to talk to Genova more about what they were doing with their new game. And you know, had a look at the early version of what would become Sky and started doing some consulting for them, helping with the economy side of things and actually understanding, okay, what is this going to look like as a live service product? You know, what is going to incentivize people to play this for years to come, as opposed to just the, you know, the 2 hours that their previous games were traditionally played for. And that those discussions sort of led to me doing some consulting for them while I was traveling, and sort of one thing led to another, and they invited me to move here to Santa Monica and join the team full time. So that was 2 years ago. So I joined that game company as the director of online experience, and that is a very nebulous title, but it really tries to capture all the things that were new for TGC as terms of the online operation of the game. So in my time there, I've worked to help build out the community team, the customer support side of things, but mostly what I've spent my time on is designing and iterating on the economy, the seasonality, the live events, and just the experience of what it's like to be a player of Sky long term. And that kind of brings us up to where we are today.
So I would love to go back to your experience when you first started working with DNA, because I would love to know what they came in with. And sort of did they sit you down and say, here is this Bible, go read this and come back to us? Did they say, here are the top 10 lessons we've learned? And what sort of free-to-play wisdom did they impart, and how did that shift the culture of your team then?
The first thing that comes to mind is the director of third party at the time, Barry Dorf. It was when I met them at this hotel suite at GDC, as I was leaving the meeting, and they'd sort of seen our stuff and they liked it, obviously, and liked it enough to organize a follow-up, and they were quite excited about it. I walk out the corridor and he turns to me as I'm leaving and he says, Tim, events. events is going to be the thing. And I'm just like, okay, cool. Like, you know, just taking on board, you know, there's a lot of hype around. But he was, you know, very, like, very particular about this. And I was like, okay, all right, I got to go back and look at this. And so this was when events were not very common. You know, like they had been a non thing in Japan and like in China and things for a long time. But really events were very new for the West. And I think our game was actually certainly one of the first casual games to incorporate events. So this is 6 years ago. And certainly it was the like our secret weapon in making the game a success. So that's something which they definitely pushed us, you know, really hard to integrate into our design. And they gave us a lot of best practice as far as how to do that. And we were really lucky in that I was able to sit in meetings where the team on very established games were looking at all of the stats from a previous, like a live event that was actually happening. And so I was just able to sort of learn by osmosis, just like sort of sit there and absorb their process and their attention to detail and that dedication they had to being very attentive to data and audience sentiment and just the heartbeat of the game. And that was just like massively inspiring because I got to take that back and sort of inject it into the culture of our team. And then we just got, even though we were in different countries, we just, you know, sucked up so much of that best practice by observing and then applying that to our game.
Yeah, I think that that's something that for me, since I did a lot of my early work in Korea, has always been interesting to me that we have had trouble replicating in the West, which is that kind of shared experience in learning where multiple teams who are working on maybe a wide variety of live games are coming together regularly and talking about their process and talking about their successes. Can you talk a little bit more about that kind of culture and how have you seen that manifest in the West?
Well, I think like the best example of that is probably GDC. You know, like I feel like I just get this massive injection of inspiration and knowledge like every GDC, and it really is like my favorite, one of my two favorite year weeks of the whole year. So I mean, it was a total bummer.
Christmas and GDC, that's yeah. It right?
Well, actually Coachella and GDC, and they're in pretty close proximity, so and of course both have been canceled this year. Yeah, I mean, it's the vibe there is incredible. Like you always feel like you're simultaneously like put in your place, you know, like you see people that are just like totally you know, blowing you out of the water in terms of your level of delivery, and it's, you've got like, oh okay, I really need to step it up, but also kind of just reminded of like your place in a positive sense, in that you sort of you see the spectrum of everything that's been created, and that's a way of helping like ground you in what's important to you, because you're reminded, oh, there's so much stuff out there, you know, like I can't be derivative. I need to do something which is different. There are all these incredibly talented people, and you know, if my game's going to matter to anybody, it needs to have some distinct message to it. So yeah, I think GDC is probably the best example we have in the West, and there's an openness about that community where there's, you know, like everyone's so forthcoming with like all of their secret sauce and tools. Like nothing is really, there's no sacred cows. Like everything's just laid out, which is fantastic, and it keeps everybody on their toes.
Well, for someone who's never had a chance to actually sit down and participate in one of those live event sort of review sessions and look at the data and look at the analytics and make decisions, can you sort of paint the picture of what it actually looks like? I mean, you know, help us imagine we're actually there sitting down in a room reviewing an event. What does it look like? What metrics are being reviewed? Yeah, like walk us through that process.
Okay, so it's going to, depending on how sophisticated your analytics department is, it's going to look either very pretty or like, you know, very dirty and just, you know, like an Excel spreadsheet. And the cool thing about when those first meetings at DNA was that when it's happening in the moment, it's like super dirty or super quick, you know, like the tools were pretty rudimentary. And really, especially because with the games that are newer, they didn't have these like fancy dashboards and stuff working yet. So, you know, they just had this raw input, which someone had just like scrambled together into a Excel spreadsheet just to be like, okay, we're 4 days into the event. completion rates on these challenges are, you know, X, Y, and Z percentage, you know, and they can see what their conversion rate is. And it's just like the project manager sitting there scrolling through this thing and just thinking out loud with his team and being like, okay, who are we leaving behind? What players are like not engaging with this? You know, what can we be doing to make this clearer and better? And then are there any like actual tweaks that we want to make real time to make sure that the right amount of people get over the finish line with this event, or we, you know, we monetize to the right level? And I just thought that was like fascinating to be like so in the moment, right? Like, so in like what was usually like, you know, the decisions we make about the changes we make to the game are felt in, you know, weeks down the road if we're lucky, but more likely, you know, months down the road. And this guy's like sitting here like chomping through the spreadsheet, you know, making decisions that are going to be alive in the game that afternoon, you know. And that I thought was just like really really inspiring.
So just bringing that down then, so the building blocks were analytics to help make decisions and some basic ones, mm-hmm. this in a spreadsheet, and the ability to make configuration changes and content changes and see them in near real time back into the game.
Yes. Yeah. That's crucial. Much more important than it looking pretty is just the ability for a quick turnaround. So being able to listen, and whether that listening is the fan sentiment or just the pure data, and getting that quickly and then acting on it.
That had to have a big impact on the way you guys approached making your next games.
Yeah, it did. I mean, the way that we approached our development in general just sort of changed so dramatically, both through exposure to DNA and their best practice, but also just taking on some of the lessons that we learned from the previous games. And it really was like a perfect storm. And I remember one of the... another moment in Flutter's development, which was really pivotal, was that we just decided that the game was going to be one screen, right? And because we were just looking at mobile and the things that were really working in DNA's portfolio and what people struggled with our previous games, and like there was just too much stuff to understand, right? There was just like too many different either game modes or controls or ideas or concepts. And we, by observing, you know, the games in DNA that were working really well, it was just this one very simple loop that players were just like, you know, fascinated like with playing over thousands and thousands of times over again. And they'd become really great at making one or two interactions just feel exceptionally good, and to have like a crazy range of nuance, you know, and challenge to them. And something which can scale up to being immediately understandable by somebody that looks at a screen. So that was our challenge, right? Which like, it's the game is going to be on one screen. Like you might be able to pan it around like a little bit later on, but just a lay person, a person that doesn't even, you know, necessarily play games, is going to be able to look at this thing and get it. You know, and then like within a couple of taps is going to understand the loop and is going to be either bought in or churned out. And so, you know, that, and then as a constraint, was very important. And this is when I was sort of learning that constraints are, you know, probably one of the most important tools that we have as developers, right? And then layering in that complexity of like, okay, so this is our 30-second loop. Great. How do we then add like the philosophy of limited time events and a metagame progression? And then that those sort of mechanics came more specifically from DNA.
Well, how much so events typically change the rules of the core loop. That's the whole point, is they sort of make something different for some period of time, which gives you that freshness and that unique kind of engagement. Like how far did you let yourselves change that core loop over the course of your events? Was it relatively constrained? Is it some very subtle shifts, or were you making some pretty dramatic changes as you tried different events?
At the start, like one of the beliefs that I still have is that it's really important for the events to be an extension of core gameplay. So it needs to like follow all the same rules, right? You shouldn't build like a different game on top of your game and then call it the event. It needs to be just like natural extension, because if it feels too much of a sideline, then it's going to feel non-essential. It's either going to feel non-essential or it's going to feel like a distraction. And so, it's really important that like it integrates beautifully, like, you know, into that 30-second loop, even if it is just like a subtle little twist. And so, for example, the first event that we did, really, it was just as simple as there was a collection of butterflies that were only available for 10 days. And there was a special flower that you could find in the environment, which you needed to collect, which you then, you know, helped you attract that species. And it was just that simple. It was like all it was really was a time limited tweak on an established mechanic. And the benefit of that is that players coming into it immediately know what to do. You know, like, you don't need to give them a rule book. You know, you don't need to explain anything complex to them. They're already bought into the game. They already value collection of all these different species. You're just adding this one little complicating factor, and they're in. They're playing and having a great time. So then over time, though, you do want to keep things a little bit interesting. So we added in subtle little changes, like we added in a new character, which was a source of the different resources and flowers that you could get. But again, it was just like a little bit of added complexity on top of a fundamentally core system, which was always driven the same way.
I think, you know, what you just said there is incredibly helpful. Like, it's that kind of direct, like, this is what it takes to make a great event. And I'm struck because you were talking about getting into events relatively early as far as the West's exposure to that kind of thinking. But I think it's one of the things that, from my perspective, is still a very difficult thing for a lot of Western developers to adopt. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know why you think that is. Why has it been so hard for us to pick up that practice that is so well developed in the East?
I think it's got something to do with the, how do I put this? The, like, the heritage design values, like, from the different markets. So, in China, especially, you know, online games have and free to play have been the norm for the entire industry's existence, right? Like, before online free to play games, there was just pirating and that was it. You know, but then when online games came along, like, the anti piracy measure, you know, really was to adopt this free to play model. And so, right from the start, like, they had to rely on that, and it just became a core part of the DNA of those studios and that business model. Whereas in the West, we've had to make a transition. You know, in the West, like, we started off as, you know, this industry where, well, actually, I suppose we started off technically in the arcades, where it was kind of a free-to-play-ish right. type thing. And but we evolved more towards this model where it was an adventure game or a story, something that had a start, middle, and end. And we got really obsessed with this idea of, like, a narrative arc, you know, and, like, and of being like movies. And I think a big part of the industry is still very fixated on that idea. And it's not to say that obviously, like, beautiful, you know, like, touching, incredible experiences have come from that. But I think there's more for us to do than just tell a linear story. And I'm not sure whether there's something culturally to do with the fact that movies are afforded, like, a sense of, like, cultural gravity, and, like, if games are going to rise to the level of importance, you know, of movies, then we need to mimic them, and that's the only real way to tell a story, or, like, to touch people, is to go through this, like, three act structure. I don't know, that's, like, probably a lot of navel gazing and stuff, but, like, I think it's something to do with, like, people thinking that to have a respectful piece of art, then it needs to be, like, this fixed story. And I think there are a lot of great examples that show that that's not the case, but I think most of the industry would still like to be focusing more on narrative-based games. So, yeah, I don't know. I think we were lucky with Runaway that we got to witness, like, a very different philosophy from the ground floor and like, weave that into our design from the beginning. And I should point out as well that we failed the first time we tried this. The first time we tried to make a butterfly game, we were, like, oh, like thinking this is going to be an adventure game. You're going to fly as this butterfly through, you know, the forest, and it's going to be really cool. And you're going to meet all these different characters, and you know, it's going to be this like epic adventure. And it just didn't work, like, you know, on the platform, because we were kind of just a little bit ignorant of how people approach these sorts of games, like whether it's on a browser or on a phone. These platforms are, you know, people are looking at them to fill in gaps of time. Filling gaps in time and like, and connect with their friends. And you need to be like respectful of like what headspace someone's in when they're, you know, approaching these devices. And I think again, like, you know, DNA taught us it a lot, and we're very humbled by our failures. And we were, I suppose, ready to absorb the lessons then. So we were lucky in a, as I say, again, a perfect storm of both having the right mentors there and being humble enough to accept that influence.
How important, when you're laying out your events or designing events, what sorts of goals do you sit down with? Are they always the same, or do they change? For example, are some events more about, you know, pure engagement? Are they about, you know, re-engaging lapsed players? Are they about monetization, specific monetization goals, trying to advance a particular cohort forward to a particular, you know, new level of engagement? Like, how do you think about goals of events, and what are some example of goals look like?
Sure. Well, I can pull an example from that game company actually, and talk a little bit about what we've done with the seasons there, because we've tried to do them a little bit differently, in that our goal has not just been revenue, although like they have been very meaningful for us in that respect, as they are for most online games these days. The thing that we're really trying to do with the seasons in Sky is to expand on the story, and to make sure that each of the seasons feels like it makes the world more Sky, and it tells the player more about the characters and the backstory. And it doesn't feel, again, this is sort of an extension of that idea that I mentioned before about it not being like a bolt-on added extra, but it more feeling like a new chapter in the story. So our goals are very much to make sure players are not just turning up to grind through and collect some currency and get a new cosmetic, but we're hopefully training them, or like inspiring them, to pay a little more attention to the subtle story elements that we hide in each of the quests, so that they can unpick the background narrative of the game, of the world. So I think we're more focused on the feeling at TGC than we are necessarily on the specific metrics. And that's not to say that we don't have dashboards where we're monitoring all this stuff very closely. But you know, each season does have a particular theme. So for example, the second season we built was called the Season of Gratitude. And that had a central theme of gratitude running through the stories, but also in the gameplay, we added in these new gratitude shrines where players could come and answer these gratitude prompts and share with the players around them things that they were grateful for in life. So we're trying to like thread in, you know, like feeling, story, gameplay, and advance, I suppose, like the philosophical ambition of the game, as well as just making new stuff for people to buy.
I think that's actually one of the things to me that's so interesting about your experience, because you do come from more of an indie space. You had that experience with DNA, but you do come from a more indie space. And so much these days, I think there's a narrative that indie, especially when we talk about live ops focused games, is either your focus is to sort of build a loop, sort of solve the problem of engagement and just sort of build loops that are more and more optimized, or you're making a narrative focused game, right? You're making a small indie premium narrative game. And I think that this space isn't really explored all that often, which is the space that you sort of occupy, which is, no, we are a live service focused game that has real intention, right? And that has intentions that you might normally associate with more, you know, indie or art focused games. So it'd be interesting to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, your experience specifically as there has been this big explosion in service games and live ops, but a lot of times the focus is really strongly on a very like business focused idea about what it means to go and do live ops or service games.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can interject before you answer that, I think one of the things I'm especially interested in hearing is your experience engaging with Genova, because Genova is probably one of the kind of preeminent narrative feeling, you know, kind of game structure. And so to bring the person sort of helping introduce him to games as services and live ops, very interesting to hear that juxtaposition and sort of the cultural shift and frankly, the cultural journey he had to go along with his team as you ramped up this new model. And I'm not surprised at all that together you've come up with a model that's sort of a new way, you know, which is combining narrative with live service. You know, I'm not surprised that that's what's come out of this collaboration.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think I felt like I had to throw away a lot of like my, what I call best practice when I came here to TGC, because, you know, you're right in that like a lot of the rules don't apply to TGC, and they really over the years have tried to push the envelope and prove that games can, you know, be more than just what we assume that they are, and which you know, had inspired me a lot in my career. Like early on when we were making Flutter, I was playing, you know, Flower, and just, you know, being so blown away by, you know, like the optimism that game sort of imbued in people, that, you know, games could be more than just, you know, money-making machines, but they could be art, they could be poetry, and they could have real, you know, emotion. And that was hugely motivating for me and had an influence on my early work. And I think, like, you know, Flutter wouldn't have had the heart that it has, you know, and which I think became a core part of its, you know, of its differentiator and the reason why it stood out, had it not been for your Flower and Journey. So it's kind of a cool full circle moment to, you know, then come back and for like those games to be the sort of certain steps in the ladder to me, then being able to come back and help contribute to expanding TGC's, you know, operation out from, you know, just being a narrative, you know, fixed storytelling style company into being a full live, you know, live ops operation. And so the hardest thing I think has been trying to like just shift the momentum away from like the way things were, you know, because it's when a company has like three games in a row under their belt where they're in a particular format and they've all done really well and they're like, you know, game of the year, critical darlings, you know, it's very hard to like even say that anything needs to change, you know, like. And but the reality is that we're making a transition, you know, still on our way to making it, away from, you know, like a 2-hour fixed narrative into a game that people ideally play for thousands, you know, of hours and are in really tight little loops. And when I first got there, it was just a matter of like just doing my best to educate. I would just share experience. And I would just do little presentations where I just said, look, this is some of the best practice we'd used at Runaway and that other teams are using around the world. And these are some of the things that we need to think about when we're making this style of game. And yeah, absolutely. Like these different mindsets like clashed like so many times, you know, and I'm really grateful for like all of the times that I've needed to stick up for, you know, like this new type of thinking, because it, you know, when my opinion like comes, you know, gets challenged as like not fitting with like the values of like the company or like the long-term aspirations, then I need to be like really sure of like why this idea is good, you know, like, and why it's relevant. And I need to then like relate it back to the core values and actually say, look, I'm not doing this purely just to make money, for us to make more money. I'm doing this, you know, I'm suggesting this design or this practice or whatever, because it's part of a good live product, you know, and our goal isn't just to like suck money out of people and then kick them out the door. Our goal is to establish a like bond with our audience and a trusting relationship over the course of years, you know, like, and it's just a different being and a different, like, different considerations that you have to take into account when you're deciding what to spend your time on, you know, like what to spend your art resource on and what to spend your game engineering resource on. And, you know, one of the key filters I think we're trying to adopt more and more is, you know, is this thing that we're building going to be useful to all our, as many of our players as possible for as long as possible to come at any stage in the game? You know, like, so anytime you're making like a one-off thing, like whether that be a cinematic or a piece of artwork or even a piece of engineering, which is only for a very niche or specific part of the audience, that has to come under like real, you know, critique. Like we need to make sure that our time is optimized so that those features and pieces of content are relevant and useful for a long time to come for our players.
One theme we've hit on in previous episodes is how the player is increasingly at the center of the design process. You know, this notion of it's no longer I, the designer, I'm creating experience that you, the player, will consume. It's more like you, the player, kind of sitting with me on the same side of the table. We're almost co-designing together, even though the player is not physically in the room. You know, the designer is really trying to engage. Love to hear your thoughts on that concept, but also then how that played out within that game company.
Sure. So it's a really tough balance because, you know, not only like do we not want to be just purely reactive, you know, to whatever the players, you know, request, but you know, we also need to be sure not to like respond to the squeaky wheel, you know? And so that's probably one of the biggest challenges I'd say in live ops in general is balancing all of these different inputs. So if as a product owner, you're sitting there and you're at the start of your sprint cycle and you're deciding what to do with your next 2, 4, 6 weeks, however long it is, and you're looking at the raw data that's coming in from your analytics, you're talking to the team and they're telling you all the things that they want to fix with the game. You're listening to your social media channels. You've got your customer support team on your back about, you know, what bugs are going on. And then you've got your own intuition to fit in there somewhere. And it's like a real skill, like, you know, bordering on like a full-time job just to like sit there and listen attentively and then make good judgment calls, you know, like on what of those things you need to listen to and what things you kind of just need to respectfully put aside.
Do you have any examples of times, I think we all have examples of this, but do you have examples of times when it really seemed like something was a big, big, big deal and you did kind of give in to that desire to act reactively and then things turned out very differently than you'd imagined?
Yeah. Okay. So a good example is from early on in Flutter's days. And I think it was when we were about a year in, and we had a lot of players, complaining that, the past events that we had run that they were not around for, had not come back and there was no way for them to access that content. And they were like super vocal about this and sort of really demanded that, or demanded in various levels of pleasant and unpleasant ways that we bring this event back. And we thought about it for ages because obviously as a team as well, we were concerned that there were by that point 5 or 6 events that we'd run that was work that we'd done, which was only ever going to be seen by this fraction of our audience that existed, because our game was on like a continual like growth trajectory. I mean, after a year we had way more players than we did at the start, so like it seemed like a waste. And so we consulted with the player base and we even did like a poll. They're like, okay, if we were to bring back an event, which event would you want to bring back? And they voted for the one which was the first ever event, you know, predictably, because that was the one that the least of them had seen. And then we decided to bring that event back. And we ran it again, and it was an absolute disaster because it didn't monetize nearly as well. So we had a really poor month because a lot of the players had actually still been around for it. It was just like the small minority that were like very, very vocal because, you know, they wanted to get the stuff. Then the players that did have that stuff back then also got really upset because they thought the integrity of, you know, the limited nature of those species had now been compromised and they didn't trust us anymore. It's like, oh, well, okay, well, if you're just going to bring these vents back anytime you like, then, like, you know, I'm just not really even going to bother finishing these things. And so that was, that didn't go great. And fortunately,
You tampered with scarcity. You had the scarce thing, and we then did. You basically suddenly made it not so scarce.
We did. And so that was a bad call. But there's a happy ending to the story, because we came up with a solution that in the end actually did work. And instead of introducing whole other seasons back, after thinking about this for a while, we came up with a system called the visiting butterflies. So it would have just one of the species from the event every few days would choose one at random from all the species you hadn't collected, would visit your forest, and you would be able to see that species, you'd be able to use its special ability, you'd be able to collect the currency from it and just play with it for that whole day at no charge. Every free player could see it. But then if you wanted to capture it, you could pay a premium to capture it and add it to your collection. And that worked really well because, all the people that were free players, it was kind of didn't really feel like it was, they were missing out. They got to see the species and everything. They didn't feel like they had to have it in their collection. But the people that were willing to pay, were happy to do so in the end, and it monetized very, very well. And so it struck a very careful balance between giving access to that old content, but not making it feel like it was a, an actual reliable source of catching up. Like it's possible, it would be possible to do, but you'd have to play for like months and months and months and months with this concept. So what it did in the end was that it increased the value, the perceived value and fun of the events while they were happening. Because you're like, oh, wow, over this 10 days, 14 days, however long it is, I get to click six of these things, like six of these like super rare things that like cost tons of money that come in. And now I get to like, just like play for free and like I pursue these things. So that worked out really well.
Do you have any techniques you use now to try to like specifically guard against that trouble of hearing a very vocal minority and only finding out, because this is such a common thing. I know I've experienced it. One group is upset about something. They want A. And then you provide A. And then the other group that was happy with the way it used to be, but were silent because they were happy before, are now unhappy. And now suddenly you just traded group A for group B. Do you have any techniques you use now when you start to hear feedback to try to suss out, is this something that is going to cause another problem down the road? Is this a vocal minority? How do you sort of vet that?
Sure. It still gets us. It does. It's hard to say no to your very vocal set of players, especially when they are dedicated fans and they've been playing the game for hundreds of hours and you want to be able to respond to them. And the instinct of course is to be like, I want to make all these fixes, whether it's a bug thing or to all these people, especially your most loyal fans. But I think the most important thing is just like taking a breath, just like taking a breath and stepping back and just asking yourself, okay, like numerically, like how many people are affected by this? And then like try and compare the influence of making that change with the time that where that time could be spent otherwise, and how you are best serving the player base as a whole. And that can become a dialogue. There's no really like empirical way to like just say, yes, this is the right course of action over X over Y. I think like sitting down and having like a calm pause where you actually talk about all the different options that you have. And then just as importantly, being communicative with the player base about why you're making the change and like what you do have the time to get through and why you've prioritized one thing over the other. So I'm like a massive fan of candor. Whenever I get the opportunity, just like super open, we'll get on a live stream happily. We'll like write a blog post, whatever we need to do. And just be like 100% transparent about like our design process and all the different things that we're trying to balance. And the reason for that is that, like, I don't know, I just believe that, like, honesty is the best policy for a start, but just through experience have seen that players just respond well to that. You know, like, if you say, guys, you know, like, we want to fix this little thing, but we're really busy creating this new season or, you know, this other new feature, which is going to help, you know, like, thousands more people, you know, better connect with their friends or something, then they're like, oh yeah, cool, I understand. And that's it. You know, it's just when players don't feel like they're being heard, that's frustrating for them. You know, like when they're sitting there going like, you guys are lazy. What have you been doing for the last few months? We've told you about this like a dozen times and they don't get acknowledged. Like that's the problem. The problem actually isn't that, you know, you're not immediately reacting to their concern. The problem is that it doesn't feel like you're listening. And like they feel like they've invested all of this time in your game and they deserve to be listened to, which they're absolutely right. So I think starting there, like you can't please everybody, but you can listen to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's something that AAA has had a bit of a struggle with as we start seeing live ops get adopted across the more traditional parts of the Western game development culture, is that ability to get out there and be in frequent communication and honest communication with the player base.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of devs I talk to are honestly like it's very nerve-wracking, right? Like the idea of getting out there and actually having to talk to players is a worry of like, will this escalate into an endless suck of time? Will they really understand it? I guess, do you have any advice for devs that are going through that?
I think like as with everything, you learn by failing. You know, so it's a right for it to be scary. And I hope that like people will trust as well that there's just as much good that comes from engaging with your player base, and you get so much positive feedback that it can be a massive source of inspiration. And my main piece of advice, I think, when sort of stepping out into this is like, try and be attentive to the fact that humans are very good at picking up on the negatives and ignoring the positives. You know, like we're, for some reason, we're just like hardwired to do this. You know, like you go into your performance review or something and you get like 9 pieces of great feedback. And like, then one thing where you need to improve and you're just like fixate on that thing and like lose sleep over it at night. And, you know, like it's rewiring our brains to try and like, you take a compliment. You know, it's probably one of the more important things we can do to our actual like happiness and productivity. And so if you can apply that to, you know, your comment thread or reading your app store reviews or whatever, and that's going to, you know, help you out a lot. And also like passing that on to your team, it's like really easy to just focus on, oh God, we got a 1-star review. What is this person concerned about? You respond to it right away. And just be in reactive mode all the time, just to complaints. And making a habit of, you know, being like, you know, we're going to celebrate our 5-star reviews and we're going to pin those, you know, reviews up and we're going to share. We're at TGC, we're super lucky. We get so many amazing fan letters and fan art. And like, we have a big community in Japan and a few for whom this game has been very meaningful in their lives. And we've had all those letters translated by our Japanese staff and read to the team and things. And like, those are just like such heartwarming moments and they give you so much juice to keep going. And they remind you like what, you know, is really important and why you're doing what you do. So yeah, like, it's scary stuff, but like, you know, just get in there, be prepared to fail and make sure that you take away like all the positives as well as just fixating on the negatives.
You know, I think one of the things I want to dig in more is this dichotomy between games as services and premium games, you know, cause I think you're right. Early on, we saw these as two very different things. Either you're doing premium or you're doing free to play and never the twain shall meet. And you're now, you know, in this space where you're kind of mixing and matching a little bit. Do you think it's a choice, or do you think there are applications from games as services that every game developer can be applying regardless of their business model? I mean, are there sort of like for example, I spend time at PopCap and Casual Games, and just the, you know, having to spend several years focusing exclusively in these super simple one-click games, I think improved, you know, how I think of hardcore games, because I think there's lessons that every hardcore gamer designer can use from the casual game space. You know, is there a similar analog here?
Yeah. It's interesting when you get into actual AAA paid games and the place of microtransactions in them. And I think actually that, you know, the core gamer demographic that are very resistant to microtransactions, I mean, are kind of rightly resistant to them when they've already paid $60 for their game. Like, I totally empathize with somebody that, you know, has saved up, you know, to, you know, pay a premium for this, like, you know, big game they've been looking forward to, and then be like staring down the barrel of, oh, like to get the full experience, you know, I need, you know, to now like buy this pack of gems or whatever. And personally, I feel like the long term, your the strategy will be more towards like games embracing free to play right from the start, as opposed to, because like the $60 price point really, like in the grand scheme, like the long term of like of a well done free to play game, is just a barrier to entry. You know, like when we've seen a few premium games, like especially MMOs, you know, transition away from that upfront cost, and then even away from the subscription model, and then more just to purely free to play. So yeah, I don't know. It's, I'm not really aware of a hybrid model that has worked super well so far. And even personally, just as a consumer, you know, I like to be able to just have a disc that I put in the machine, you know, like, and then that's it, you know? And, but then equally as a consumer, I'm totally fine when I pick up my phone or even play like a game on a Switch or, you know, download your Apex or whatever. Like, I know what I'm in for. I know what, like, and it's the key thing, right? Expectations. Like, there are a whole bunch of expectations which come along with the format that you're receiving the game on, and even like the pedigree of the developer, like what the developers have given you before. And like, when there's a mismatch in your expectations and reality, that's when people get upset. So I think just, you know, knowing your audience and not trying to like fleece them, you know, or do things that are like unfair. But again, you know, like we're learning, you know, like this is just all like, you know, this is changing under our feet all the time. And so I don't think people should be afraid to try stuff, but I do think that if you're considering free to play for your game, then go all in on it, you know, because I think there's enough case studies now to show that, if you do it right, then it is like, you know, a great business model. So
one more term, and then maybe we'll ask you some of our favorite questions, which we ask everyone, which is a train wreck section of the show. But I want to talk about community for a second, and to what extent, you know, we've one of our theories here that Kristen actually really gets all the credit for is this notion that games, you know, we're already kind of post services now. We're in this sort of game as community. This notion that if you're successful, the game really is a community of players who are continually engaging, and it's way deeper than just having this ongoing service model. Do you think about that consciously, you know, especially the game you're designing now with Sky? Do you think about it as a community, and is it different in any way when you're designing to be a community per se than, you know, maybe what you're doing with Flutter, where perhaps it was more about a more isolated experience?
Absolutely. And we have been trying to think of Sky more as like a social network than as a game. And I think we've been like varying levels of successful, like with getting there. And like, we're continuing to work harder on making it just like a fun place to hang out, as well as like a cool game to play. But one thing we've definitely found with the players who stay in the game long-term is that like, really the game's like an excuse to hang out, you know, in the same way that like pick up basketball or something, you know, like the game's fun, whatever, but it's cool if you're just bad at it, you know, like it doesn't really matter. Like it's about the people. It's not about the game. And there's also like a added layer of kind of fandom community interest with our stuff, because, you know, there is a there's a lore to unpick and discover. And so there's like this tribal knowledge to share. And that's like a, you know, with Animal Crossing coming out now, you're like, that's a whole thing which everyone's getting exposed to in a whole another level. And so yeah, it's like we are trying more and more to think about introducing mechanics that bring people together, give them good excuses to hang out, to get to know each other better. And ultimately, you know, good social mechanics are the best retention tool by a long shot. So if you build up a friend group in a game, then it's much more likely that you're going to come back for months and years to come. And it just develops a real, you know, a place in your heart. You know, when you have good friends and your reliable, you know, teammates to go out with. So it's I think it's the reason why our game's been successful, and we're trying to, you know, emphasize that more in the future development.
Okay, I think it is time for us to ask our favorite question. Can you share with us a live ops disaster from your experience? Some experience that you've been through with a live game that has been a train wreck that you've learned from.
Okay. Well, I was actually going to use my story of the launching the old event, but I jumped the gun a little bit there. So I'm just going to have to think of another one on the spot. There's been so many. It's hard to know where to start.
Take note, audience members. There's been so many. This yes. is, don't feel bad when you have your own, oh my God, the economy is tanking moment, because you're not alone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. So, I mean, economy ones are like, you know, very, very easy to find, right? Because, I think, Steve Maritsky, you pointed out this classic failure as well, in that, you made a soft currency economy where you buy more generators of that soft currency, and just like this loop that very quickly gets into a place where the soft currency is worth nothing. And like, you know, it's rolling, you know, the number of digits won't fit on the screen anymore. And you know, I have a screenshot from some people that sent to me, like burnt into my retinas, which is, yeah, of the currency running off the side of the screen. You know, and of course, this is one of the ways that we're supposed to, you know, incentivize monetization. But that was a, you know, good early lesson as to why a hard currency is crucial. But let me think, I'm actually kind of blanking on another good example just at the minute.
I do love that visual of the soft currency digits just overflowing the screen. I have definitely worked on games where we actually hit the big int number, and were unable to properly store or display any more currency to a player. I won't name names.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about disasters, like a lot of the things that come to mind actually are, you know, happy disasters, in that, you know, people were up in the middle of the night, like responding to server issues because, you know, Apple or, you know, Facebook have unknowingly given us some, you know, good promotion. And then suddenly there's this massive influx of players. And we've had to deal with that with Sky at various points. And this happens obviously not just from promotions, but for whatever random social reason on the internet, someone, you know, like a streamer catches onto your game. And that's actually a very important thing for anybody that's interested in transitioning to live ops, especially as a small team, to take very seriously, is having a proper alert system set up, so that, you know, you are woken up in the middle of the night if you need to be. But also there's another reason why those systems are important, and that's so that your engineers can step away from their Slack or step away from their computer. Because early on in our time at Runaway, it became a real challenge for our engineers to, like, you know, get good sleep or get good time away from work, because they felt so responsible for the system standing up. You know, and before we had, you know, a good like PagerDuty style notification system where it would actually physically call their cell phone or call their house when something was really bad, you know? They just felt like they needed to be checking in all the time. And that's really unhealthy. And it's something which, you know, is very easy to get carried away with, whether you're an engineer or like a designer, economy designer, community support person. You know, you feel the live, living nature, you know, of this game, like, you know, just out there all the time. I mean, like, we've got, you know, like hundreds of thousands of people playing the game today. And so you're like, it's very hard to, you know, disconnect yourself from that. And when you have these solid tools that you can rely on, that you know are going to be able to get through to you on like a harder line, you know, than just your email or like, you know, a dashboard or something, then that gives you permission, I think, like to step away and be like, it's okay, the thing's stable. If it all, you know, goes to heck, then they're going to be able to find me. So that's probably one of the best pieces of advice I can give to sort of avoid burnout, engineering burnout, and give people the opportunity to step away from the product.
Yeah, I think that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we have so many more questions. We need to bring you back for a future episode, because I could just keep going, but I know we're getting close to our time here.
Sure, yeah. I'll be happy to. But
yeah, no, this was really fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time. Yeah, we do like to keep them around an hour so that we don't burn people out. But yeah, it would be great maybe to have you back at some point. We'll start rolling back through people. And
you just started talking about tools.
Yeah, I know.
Let's go with
and like that one too is such a great practical piece of advice, right? That a lot of times you don't think about when you're a small team, which is, hey, it really is important that you can get a phone call in the middle of the night to tell you the server is crashing. Otherwise, you really do end up with everybody sort of anxiously staring at a screen all day and all night.
Yeah. It's a very bad habit to be in, to when you wake up in the middle of the night, just open your phone and just like flick through just to see if anything's gone wrong. Like, you definitely don't want to have that habit.
No, it's hard to break, right? One of the first things you get into with live teams, and I went through this at ArenaNet, where we sort of transitioned them to a real sort of live team mentality. And going through that launch was, it's going to be a marathon, and you can't treat it like a sprint, because if you start treating it like a sprint, you're going to be sprinting until you fall over.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, like, I'm not really sure there's any way for any new team to avoid that. Like, as you try as you might, like, there's just going to be, there's so much pressure with like starting a new business model, starting a new game and things, like, there's going to be an intensity. But like, even just having that awareness that like that is not going to be sustainable, and you need to be moving yourself step by step towards a point where your whatever your level of engagement, you know, like, and work is, like, you should be able to keep up with that indefinitely. And that's a question that we've been asking our team more at TGC. It's like, you know, okay, the amount that you're working right now, could you just do that forever? And of course, a lot of them would just be like, no way. Well, it's like, okay, well, that's the start of a discussion.
Right.
Then we can just say, okay, what is it about this that we can fix? And there's lots of different stories about the ways the different teams have juggled those. And maybe that's a discussion for another day.
Well, yeah. Thanks again.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Cool.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, guys. Right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Stay safe. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Live Ops podcast.
If you liked what you heard, remember to rate, review, and subscribe so others can find us.
And visit playfab.com for more information on solutions for all your Live Ops needs.
Thanks for tuning in.